So once upon a time, there were two children, a brother and a sister, and they lived alone with their mother. Their father had died. And they were very poor. They didn't have much money at all, and sometimes they didn't know where their next meal was going to come from. And one day, their mother got really sick, and of course, the children were really sad about that, and the mother knew that she didn't have long to live, but she said to her two children, because she loved them so much, "You don't need to worry, because I'm going to come back, and I will take care of you. I promise I will always take care of you. Always." And shortly after, and she said, "And my brother is going to take you, and you can live with your uncle." And so shortly after that, she died, and they went and lived with their uncle. And they told their uncle that their mother said that she would come back and take care of them. And he said, "Oh, I don't think so, but don't worry, I'll take good care of you." And he was a really nice man. He was a really kind person. But he also was very poor and sometimes had a hard time finding enough food to feed the family. And one day, a beautiful, beautiful white goose flew into the yard of their house. And the children ran up to the goose because it was so beautiful and had golden eyes. And the goose spoke to them and said, "I'm really your mother. And I had to appear as a goose here, but I want you to know that every night, take one feather from my, pluck one feather from my wings. And then in the glowing of the sunset, expose that feather and it'll turn to gold. And then give it to Uncle, so that he will be able to use it to get money to feed you and to have good clothing." And so the children started doing that. Every night they would go and there would be this beautiful, beautiful goose, and she would willingly put out her wing and they'd take a feather from her and they would hold it up to the sunlight and it would turn into gold. And they would run and take it to their uncle. And he was so happy. He just said, "Oh, this is wonderful." And one day they said, "Well, this really is our mother." And he said, "Oh, don't be silly. That's not your mother." But he took the gold feather and he'd go to the market and they had lots of wonderful food and they had all the clothing they needed. And bit by bit, each day, they were able to have a better living style. And one day he added on to the house and they had a new kitchen. And pretty soon they had everything they needed. Everything they needed. They had a comfortable house with a beautiful garden. They had nice clothing and they had delicious foods. Probably much like you guys have, huh? Everything you need. Absolutely everything. And they were very happy. But the uncle started thinking, "You know, if only I had more feathers, I could even build a bigger house. And I could get somebody else to do the gardening. And I wouldn't have to work at all." And so he said to the children, "Well, why don't you get a couple of feathers?" And they said, "Oh no, our mother said only one feather at a time." And he said, "Okay, well." And he let it go. And then a few days later, inside he started thinking about everything he wanted that he didn't have. And that out there in the yard was this beautiful goose. And if he took all the feathers off that goose, he could have everything in the world that he wanted. He could have yachts. He could have wonderful, wonderful banquets. He could put on big parties for the whole city and everybody would think he's really important and like him. He thought, "Oh, I can get everything I want if I could just have all of those feathers." And the children said, "No, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Our mother said only one feather at a time." And so he said, "Okay." And a few weeks passed, and he kept mulling over all the things that he wanted. And finally he decided one afternoon when the children were at school that he was going to take all the feathers off that goose, because then he'd have all the gold he needed to have everything he could possibly dream of. And so he went out in the yard and he started plucking the goose. And he plucked one feather and then another and then handfuls, and he was stuffing them into a bag. And pretty soon the goose was kind of shivering because she was losing all her feathers. And when he had all the feathers off her, she ran into the bushes. And he took the feathers out and he shook them on the ground for the sunlight to shine on them. And they just stayed as white feathers. They didn't turn into gold. And he didn't know what to do. And the children came home and said, "What have you done? What have you done?" And he said, "I've taken all the feathers." He said, "I'm so ashamed. I'm so sorry. I took more than I should. I took too much." And he really felt bad. He repented. And the goose had disappeared for a long time, and the children were very sad. But eventually she came back again. And when she came back, they knew it was the same goose because she still had golden eyes, but she couldn't speak anymore. And she was covered with gray feathers. And she was just like an ordinary goose in the yard. But the uncle took very, very good care of her, and he called her my sister. And the children took very, very good care of her, and they called her my mother. And, you know, that's really how the earth is for us, too. If we take too much, then the earth suffers. And she is our mother. So when we take the two promises, we vow to protect her. And not only just our mother, but protect all living things, because all living things come from the earth. And all living things are related to us. All living things are like our brothers and our sisters. So we take good care of them, just like we take good care of ourselves too. So did you guys learn a song yesterday to teach us? Oh, great. Will you teach us a song? Can you stand up? And would you like one of the adults to be there with you, helping you? Or are you fine just teaching it to us?
Which one of you is going first? It's you, right, Noah? Which one of you decided to go first?
With me.
A clear blue sky.
clear blue sky. Mosquitoes come and mosquitoes go. My mind is a clear blue sky. My mind is a clear blue sky. My mind is a clear blue sky. Tides come and tides go. My mind is a clear blue sky.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You are free to go if you like, but you're also welcome to stay if you like. It's a no-brainer. Yeah, thank you. Please bow to our Sangha, okay? I have a question here. It says, please advise what a beginning meditator who is also a senior citizen should pay most attention to or do when starting a practice and what to avoid. I think that the sutra we read this morning, the Discourse on Happiness, speaks very much about what is helpful in our lives to cultivate each one of those things we mentioned today, we read today. One of my teachers, A. Kimmershi, also says it's essential for anyone who is truly on a spiritual path to have a daily meditation practice, to have a sangha, a community of support, to have a special Dharma friend, at least one. It's helpful if it's somebody who is more practiced that you can bring questions to and share your insights with. And to attend retreat on a regular basis, at least once a year. Those of us who wear the brown coats have a commitment to do 60 days of retreat each year. So 7 days is very nice, but longer is wonderful. And if you really wish to answer for yourself this question about birth and death, it's important to have a teacher who you meet with regularly. We're going to have a 30-day retreat this summer at Mountain Lamp. It'll begin. It'll be the whole month of July. And we did a 21-day retreat last year in May. We had a number of people, goodly number of people, who came for the whole retreat. It was very wonderful. Also, friends who joined us for a week or 2 weeks, or even just a weekend. And that will be possible this summer as well. So the question that the Diamond Sutra posed us yesterday was, how do good women and good men master their thinking. How do good women and good men master their thinking? You know, the first step in a meditation practice is learning the practice of stopping. Sometimes it's called stillness as well. And yet that stillness or that stopping is not something that's repressive or subduing. And in our meditation, it's important that we are very much alive. And the ways we stay alive is by having a place of focus that holds us, that we can take refuge in. I spoke about yesterday about counting our breaths. And if we find ourselves dreamy or sleepy, if we find ourselves drifting or distracted, then having that as a practice is very important. Having that as a foundation is very important. Another really wonderful practice is the practice of listening. It's also a very awake practice. And it is important that we are awake, because meditation is to be awake, is to cultivate the Buddha mind. And so in our meditation, it's important that we take ourselves in hand to really be awake and not let ourselves fall into dreamy and sleepy places, to come back, to come back. And if we need to open our eyes, we should. In fact, I usually keep my eyes open enough that I have light coming in. I don't keep them wide open and staring, but unfocused, with light coming in, and to be awake to that. It's real important. It's only from that place of being alert and awake that we can know what thoughts are arising, what feelings are arising, what's coming up. And when things arise, we don't need to do anything with them. We don't necessarily need to take them up. We just need to know they are there and breathe with them. And they will come and they will go, like we just sang. And still underlying that is our awakeness, our alertness. In the song that our mind is a clear blue sky, you know, the sun is always shining. Our mind is always alert. But things cloud that over. That awakened mind is the mind of Buddha. And clouds, feelings, things get in the way of us realizing that. My personal training and the first half of my working life was as an ecologist. And in fact, I took the first ecology class that was offered at the University of Washington with Gordon Oriens a long time ago. And I was really struck by the study of ecology, because it was, this seems so true, a science that pointed to that everything is connected to everything else, that all life in the universe, both sentient and non-sentient, is bound together. And in my work and in my study, I could see that so truly as a living reality, that nothing was separate. In Buddhism, this understanding of interconnectedness is the basis for understanding karma. And I want to speak about karma today because I'm going to be speaking about the precepts or the mindfulness trainings. We'll have a transmission ceremony tomorrow of the five mindfulness trainings. And tonight there will be a panel of students who will speak about their experience with practicing with the mindfulness trainings. So it is important to understand that interconnectedness is related to karma, is the basis for karma. Karma is often spoken of as action or deed, and the Buddha spoke of it as the law of cause and effect. This is because that is. Our actions, our voluntary actions, bring about certain events. And our actions spring from our thinking. And that's why it's so important to have enough stillness and enough awake alertness, attentiveness, to know what our thoughts are. If greed and hatred and thoughts of delusion or separation arise within us, and we act out of that, then that will create in the world greed and hatred and thoughts of separation, hostility, delusion. And if we have good-heartedness, if we're filled with good-heartedness and generosity and love, then that is what we create in the world. That's what manifests in the world. These are the seeds that are planted in the field of consciousness. And we know that the Bible says we reap what we sow. And so if we are sowing seeds of greed in the world, then the effects of that will be what we reap. If we sow anger in the world, we know that's what will come back to us. If our life is filled with aggression that's arisen from the seeds in the past, we can see a direct correlation there. I don't mean this as a place for guilt or self-judgment. But there is, in one level, a one-to-one correlation between what we sow in the world and what we reap, what comes to us. And there is a certain place where, when something bad is happening in our lives, we can even look and see, where did this come from in the past? How am I involved in this? What is my relationship to this? And it's a way to examine what's unfolding in our lives. Our tendency, of course, is to, when something unpleasant is happening in our lives to blame somebody else for it. Or the situation. Or try to get away from it. But our practice as bodhisattvas is to stay right here and to look into it, to try to understand. When we experience joy and love, we're realizing the fruits of past actions. And karma is not as simple as that. Okay, so those were two points that I made. First, you know, in the moment we reap what we sow, you know, in a very immediate sense. And also when bad things or difficult things or really good things are happening in our lives, we can know that there are also seeds that have been sown in the past that are influencing that. So two points. And the third point I want to make is that it is really much more complicated than that. Because, as I said from the very beginning, the understanding of interconnectedness is the understanding of karma. Clearly our life is shaped by many things. Our genetics, where we were born, where we've lived, who our parents were, how we were treated. And so there's many things in our lives that we can't change and we can't control. But because everything is interconnected, everything shapes and influences everything else. Because of that, all of our energy should be directed at harmonizing as much as we can with this unfolding universe. A dear old friend of mine, a Benedictine priest and Zen master, Villegas Jäger, describes it this way. He likens it to a chess game. He said, "One move leads to another, and no move is without meaning for the game as a whole. The game follows its own immanent laws, but we can give direction to these laws with every move of our life." This is a felicitous expression of emptiness and oneness. That everything we do not only affects our own life, but affects the whole. And the universe is all moving together at the same time. And we are part of it all. And that's why our actions are important. And it is why knowing our thoughts is important. So this speaks to both our oneness with the universe and also the natural flowing, the emptiness that has no separate self. And it also points to an understanding of each of our own unique and special existence. That what we do matters, that who we are matters, and that what we do is a contribution to the whole. And at the same time, we are a reflection of the whole. The universe is reflecting through us. So the Diamond Sutra asks this question, how do good men and good women master their thinking? I'm reading several different translations of the Diamond Sutra, and another one translates that as, how do good men and women bring their desires under control? And another one from the Buddhist Bible by Goddard is translated as, how do good men and women attain tranquility of mind? So there, that just how that is, those three translations express point first of the peace that we can touch and how that relates to our freedom. mastering our thinking, being sovereign over our actions. And the sutra goes on to say, by letting go of our ideas of four things, and I'm going to just talk about one of them today, which is letting go of our ideas of self, also sometimes translated as ego. You know, our teacher, Tai, says that our self is made up of non-self elements. When we were tasting the raisin today, we were tasting some of those non-self elements. We were tasting the sweet sugars of the grape that are made by the sun, that are from the earth. We were tasting the rain. We were also knowing that the farmer's energy was there too, and the energy of the trucks that brought the grapes to the factory where they were dried, and the energy of the machines that dried them, the grocer who put them out. All of that energy was there in that raisin. The raisin is made up of the whole universe. The raisin is made of non-self elements. The Buddha spoke about self as being simply a flow of thoughts, of feelings, of perceptions, and that we hold together in kind of a delusion of something permanent and solid, when in fact everything is always flowing. Our thoughts, our feelings, and our perceptions. And if we look at those, where do we find a self? So this is a bit analytical. Certainly, we can look at the world with these eyes, and it's helpful to look at the world with these eyes. It is helpful to look at the world with the eyes of an ecologist all the time. But in terms of our practice, how do we let go of self? When we taste the raisin with no thoughts at all, just enjoying the wonderful flavor, where is our self? Let go completely. So we let go of self, our sense of self, our ideas of who we are, by letting ourselves, giving ourselves to experience this moment. It's moment by moment touching in with what's right here. Sometimes it's imaged as a river flowing. And our awakeness, our mindfulness, is like a ball just touching in. But it's always flowing. It's always moving. And we just touch in with it, and we touch in with it. So we touch in when we hear the eagles crying in the trees. And we let go of all our thinking about where we need to go or what we need to do or who we should be talking to. We let go completely. And the eagle sings in our own heart. The eagle is our own voice. Where does the eagle end? Where does it begin? Where do we end? Where do we begin? And our practice is very much like that, moment by moment, giving ourselves away. In the sutra we read, Tori Zenji, this morning, Tori Zenji spoke about relinquishing ourselves completely. And the most pure and profound faith arises. And on each moment's thought, there appears a lotus flower. It's a beautiful poem. On each lotus flower there is revealed a Buddha. The Buddha glorifies Sukhavati, the pure land. Mm. when we tasted the raisin, when we just tasted the raisin, just the flavor of the raisin was wonderful. There was no thought of me tasting or of the raisin. It was just the flavor. We awaken to the flavor of the raisin, and it is very delicious. And if self, ideas of self and ideas of raisin fall away completely, something very wonderful happens. Tibetan texts talk about a subtle body which is carried forth from moment to moment. When we look at the waves on the shore, you know, we see a wave comes up, and the wave is a force of energy or a kind of action, and it lands on the shore. It moves the sand or the rocks or the shells around. And maybe it exposes a clam, and that clam being exposed draws a seagull to it that eats the clam. So the force or energy of an action is transferred to another existence. And the same is true with our actions. You know, if we act from the goodness of our being, the inherent goodness of our being, if we touch that and know that inherent goodness of our being, if we're filled with goodwill, then that results in positive effects now. But also that goodwill plays out in the future. There's a word in... I believe it's a Pali word called vasana. You can find it in some of the sutras. It's a perfuming. It means like perfuming. And the way that jasmine tea is made is that the tea leaves are put in a container with jasmine flowers. And the flowers, the scent of the flowers, pervades the tea leaves. And the tea then becomes scented with the jasmine. And that's what we taste. I have a dear friend who was once very, very serious about ice skating. As a young woman, she was trained as an ice skater, you know, one of those beautiful dancing ice skaters. And she trained her body in really specific ways and developed her muscles and the way she moves. And as she's grown older, she stopped ice skating, but she started doing Tai Chi, and she says that the training that she had as an ice skater plays out in the way she does Tai Chi. That it's like there's a body wisdom that has been trained. And in that same way, and we've all trained our bodies in certain ways, and in that same way we can train our minds. We can train our minds by touching seeds of peace and generosity over and over again. And then tasting the fruits of that, seeing how they live in our lives. And in that way, our actions enforce or strengthen a pattern within us. In some ways, this is related very much to cognitive therapy. In cognitive therapy, we understand the difficulties of the past, the things that we have experienced in the past that have caused great pain in our lives, and in that way thwarted us or caused us to be defensive or think in certain ways. And when we know what those patterns are somewhat, then we begin to act in a different way, so that the results are different. And when we see the fruits of that, then that begins to heal the past. So I'm speaking now about how our actions heal not only the future, create the future, but also heal the past. And when we are sitting in meditation and we are awake, we come to know very intimately what our thoughts are. But if we haven't got established in that place of mindfulness, then we can't pay attention. We can't know what our thinking is. It runs along unconsciously. When we begin to be able to be really present, nourishing ourselves in the presence, tasting the raisin, when a thought arises, we know a thought has arisen. When a feeling arises, we know a feeling has arisen. And we don't have to do very much about that, except to be awake and know it's there. And continue to come back to our place of mindfulness. If we're eating, we eat. If we're walking, we walk. We come back, not to push it away, but to be able to hold it, to be able to be in its presence without losing our awareness, without being swept away. When we get to know ourselves in that way, we start to see patterns of our thinking. And with the precepts holding us, we see when that thinking leads to action that's caused distress for ourselves or for others. And when we see that there's been a difficulty in our lives, a mess, it's good to step back and to kind of look at it, and look at it in the light of the precepts. Not as a place of judgment or guilt or I shouldn't have done that, but as a way for understanding. Like, oh, what happened here? What were the thoughts? What was the energy? What was propelling that action? And start to look at it, understand it a little better, and then simply think about how we might do it differently. Give ourselves permission to try to do it differently. So we are planting a seed in that way for this and for future lifetimes, but we are also healing the past by doing that. And we really can't say we're doing this for our life. But we also can't say it's not for our life. What we do leaves an imprint on that subtle body as well. So our thoughts and our actions in each moment not only shape the profound pattern of our own lives, it also nourishes the field, the universal field of consciousness, which is empty, which has no body to be found and no separate existence. There is an energy here, and that energy of that subtle body, which is no body at all, feels like love. Again, Tori Zenji spoke about it completely accurately this morning when he said, that everything is imbued with light. Everything arises from light and everything is light. And this mind, this universal consciousness that we are intimately part of, that we have never been separate from, that no matter what we do, we'll never be separate from. It is from that mind that the precepts arise. This is what they cultivate within us. The mindfulness trainings are not rules. They're not even guidelines. They come from within us, and they shine through the light of love into our lives by letting ourselves get out of the way, by not being caught in our ego self and our ideas. This has been the truth from ancient times, from the beginningless past. We are the universe's dream of itself. We are the light of its manifestation. And completely interconnected, all of us. And the feeling of that is love. So to receive and practice and study the mindfulness trainings allows for their influence to gradually shape the pattern of our life. And in this way, we shape the universe, even as we, in turn, are being shaped. So tomorrow there will be an opportunity for you, if you wish, to take a vow to receive, study, and practice the five mindfulness trainings as a way to deepen your practice and your insight. And that'll be talked about further tonight. To understand completely what the Buddha experienced when sitting under the Bodhi tree. Is what our practice is about. To touch deeply into the field of the universal consciousness from which we arise and which holds us always. But, you know, it's one metaphor is like that there's white light and a whole light, and then that light fragments into many pieces of light. A light named Rico, a light named Marcy, a light named Kate, a light named Waves, a light named Eagle, a light named Coyote. And our practice is not to return to the source in that sense. Nor is it to evolve into something. But it is to realize what is right here, right now. And it can only be realized right here, right now, within this body. It can't be realized in the past, because the past no longer is. And it can't be realized in the future, because the future has not yet come. And it can't be realized by our thinking mind, by our ego mind, our self, because our self is perceived as separate. So our practice is simply coming back to this moment, tasting the fruits of this moment, breathing the fresh air, hearing the sound of the waves, smiling, being in touch with each other, letting our feet touch this great earth, and planting seeds, good seeds from the goodness of our heart, from the universal goodness that we are. Planting seeds of peace, of joy, of well-being, for our sake, but for the sake of the whole universe, for the sake of the whole world, all those individual shining lights that are no other than the whole. So we have lots of time to practice together, and it's not raining, so it'd be lovely to go for a walk on the beach together. Once again, we can meet down in front of Totem in about 10 minutes after we've had a chance to get bundled up and get our shoes on.